You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Welcome to Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. This week, we'll turn to Dr. Amara Enya, Policy and Research Director of the Movement for Black Lives, to discuss the results of a new survey showing that the majority of Black Americans support divesting from police departments and investing in the things that keep people safe, healthcare, education, mental health services, and more. Then we'll spend the rest of the hour with Chama Sawant, the firebrand Seattle Socialist City Council member who, after a decade in office, is moving on to lead a labor organizing effort. In an in-depth conversation, Sawant will share her analysis of why liberal lawmakers don't live up to their ideals and how to hold them accountable. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A new survey by the Movement for Black Lives shows broad support among Black Americans for defunding police and refunding alternatives to policing. The survey, conducted in collaboration with Gen Forward at the University of Chicago, specifically shows that 67% of Black Americans support reallocating part of police budgets toward investments in healthcare, education, and housing and other areas, while 55% support divestment from police departments and allocating entire police budgets towards such investments. At a time when media coverage of the racial justice demands from summer 2020 has waned, the study renews the urgency of reimagining the institutions that cause racial violence and harm. We turn now to Dr. Amara Enya, Policy and Research Director for the Movement for Black Lives. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So first, let's talk about how the survey was conducted and why. Why was it restricted also specifically to Black Americans and not conducted across Americans of all races?
Sure. So the survey was really important because over the last several years, particularly since 2020, there have been so many conversations around transformation of the police system, defunding the police system, problems with the carceral state, and the harms that have been caused. So, of course, we had the uprisings in 2020, which were in response to the murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And then we had, not just in the United States, but globally, there were uprisings around this kind of violence. And so out of those uprisings came demands from communities around the transformations that needed to happen to keep people safe. And police, of course, was a large factor in that. And whether or not reforms are enough, whether or not to continue investing in police and policing in light of the harms that have been caused by police, particularly in Black communities. And so this survey is designed to really answer and to ask and answer some critical questions as it relates to policing and the system of policing and what communities want, and specifically what Black communities want, what they are articulating. And so that was the importance of the survey and really being able to have a more nuanced view of the interventions that are necessary to address public safety.
Were you surprised by the results, by the extent of support among Black Americans for, you know, reinvesting funds meant for policing into other non-police alternatives?
Not really surprised. So one of the really powerful aspects of this survey and this report is that it does provide a more nuanced view of the thoughts within the Black community around policing, and specifically around moving funds away from policing and actually shifting them into the things that our communities have articulated make them more safe. So investing in non-carceral responses, crisis interventions, investing in other things like housing, education. We actually saw a lot of these responses in some of the grassroots work that took place after the uprisings, just talking to people in their communities when they would share what are the things that create safety. And it became clear in those deeper conversations that police is not the starting point and the ending point of safety in Black communities. And in fact, when asked the question, as it was done in this report, of whether to move funds that go to policing to some of the other areas that they feel actually keep them safe, the responses were in the affirmative. And so it just underscores the fact that not only are people saying, yes, the system of policing has caused so much harm, but we're also unpacking what the alternatives look like and an appetite for investing in alternatives that might actually create better outcomes for our communities.
So when we look at the breakdown by age, I noticed that there is an interesting breakdown, generational breakdown within the Black community. Just even this idea of, would you be willing to call the police when crisis hits? Do you fear calling the police? Give me a sense of that. What you found in the survey in terms of differences generation-wise?
Well, there are definitely some differences generation-wise, but in some instances, they were not huge differences. So on the question that you named about people, how people feel about calling the police if they have to, that's a really important question, because as we've seen over the last several years, in some instances where police were called, it actually escalated the situation or deaths occurred. And so there's this hesitancy, particularly with younger people, those in the younger generation, with calling the police. When you look at older respondents, the hesitation around calling the police was a little bit less. However, if given the alternative, so one of the questions is, if given the alternative to call another entity, agency, or, you know, have some alternative to police, that they actually would utilize that alternative, which is a very, very important point. You have people who, depending on their age, there are differences in terms of their willingness to call the police, But in both instances across the age spectrum, when provided with an alternative, they would actually utilize that alternative. And that's a really important point that plays a role in the kinds of interventions that we should be pushing from a policy standpoint and the alternatives to policing that we can actually be building in our communities.
One of the things that is so striking, not just specifically about the survey, but in general, is of course that the familiarity with the criminal justice system that Black Americans have just because of disproportionate racial targeting is so different, especially compared to white America. Did your survey examine that? And if so, what did you find?
Well, it definitely examines that. So you'll see that come out in some of the questions around people's attitudes toward police, how willing they are to call the police, even in an emergency, how willing they are to lean into other alternatives. Even some of the opinions that that we found people shared about their willingness to, their desire to actually move funds away from policing and invest it into other mental health responses, alternative crisis response services rather than police. You're seeing all of these attitudes being reflected because they speak to the relationship that Black communities in particular have had with the police, which has been fraught, right? So instances of death at the hands of police, feeling unsafe because of police, and how we define safety. What you're seeing in the survey results, where you're seeing large percentages of respondents saying that they prefer alternatives, they prefer to have alternatives, and when those alternatives are made available, they would prefer them over police. That's very, very important because it is answering this question of if we're not going to the police as the first step or the first go-to, then who are we calling? What is the alternative? That's important because it's us asking that difficult question, but also answering that question. And so the answers to that question, meaning the interventions that we should be proposing, are coming out in the responses that we found in the survey, because people are literally saying, yes, we would prefer to actually utilize mental health respondents, a mental health crisis response, some kind of alternative. And that informs what kinds of policies we should be getting behind and what we should be pushing with policymakers, with legislators, and it's supported by the data.
Now, when there are high-profile killings of particularly Black Americans by police, the calls for reforms become louder, and you end up, especially even among liberal lawmakers who say they support racial justice, the knee-jerk response is to pour more money into policing to try to get better training or have greater racial diversity in among police departments. Does your survey address that, the issue of reforms and reformism?
It does. It does in many ways. So the fact that close to 55% of Black people said that they were either strongly or somewhat believe in divesting from police departments and putting their entire budget toward investments in other areas. And those other areas include healthcare, education, and housing. That's a huge statement. It speaks to when people say reform, so often it's this tweaking around the edges of police and policing. It's things that we know don't really get to the root causes of harm that come from the policing system. So the fact that you have these percentages who are saying they are actually in favor of putting the entire budget toward investment in other areas. We also are seeing that 86% of Black people support creating a new agency of first responders who specialize in de-escalating violence and providing mental health support and other social services. That's a huge percentage saying essentially that it's not just enough to tweak around the edges of policing. We actually support first responders who specialize in de-escalating violence, and that's where the resources should go. So when you see a lot of frustration around reform, a lot of that is because the reforms have been not really getting to the root causes of the harm, and the perceptions that Black people have about what is actually going to create better outcomes, what will create safety. And so we are seeing 88% of respondents support hiring mental health professionals. What does that tell us about how when in emergency situations, what the response should actually be? It's telling us that perhaps we should be looking at other alternatives rather than police showing up on the scene, perhaps hiring more mental health responders, perhaps diverting some of those funds that are going into policing. As you mentioned, it's always additional funding for police, and we're still seeing these kinds of outcomes. Actually diverting some of those funds to some of these other things that people have said would actually create better outcomes, would actually make them feel safe, would actually help them feel that the system is not a system of harm. And that's really, really important. And it's the kind of nuance that this report shows.
So it matters how one defines reforms then. And that's where there's a lot of disconnect, right, between the sort of mainstream discussion around policing, which generally revolves around additional body cameras, how to train police to, you know, use different kinds of chokeholds. Rather than how to replace police with non-policing alternatives, how to have a 911 dispatcher send somebody who is unarmed and who has special training in mental health crises rather than a cop. Those are two very different kinds of reforms.
Absolutely. Absolutely different kinds of reforms, and really just speak to the dissonance and the distance between what has been pushed, particularly in the mainstream, and what our communities are saying are necessary. So you mentioned the danger of a traffic stop, right? There are questions around why armed police officers are making traffic stops, especially when reports had come out, I believe, in Mississippi about the use of traffic stops as revenue generators and increasing contact with police, and those that increased frequency of contact can create increased frequency of poor outcomes, violent situations, and so on and so forth. And so the question then becomes, well, why should armed police be pulling people over for traffic violations, right? Or why should police be giving bicyclists tickets, right, for riding their bike on the sidewalk, for example? Why should there be those kinds of interactions? Why should individuals who are having a mental health crisis, why should armed police be called to the scene, especially in instances where they may have exacerbated or escalated a situation? These are very valid questions that have been asked, and it's why you're seeing this friction about the kinds of reforms that have been pushed and that have been sort of given high visibility versus the kinds of reforms and really transformations and systems change that can actually create better outcomes, mitigate, minimize, eliminate the harms completely that have come from these violent police interactions.
And so when we hear the slogan defund the police, given these survey results, how should one interpret that three-word slogan, which is a really important rejoinder to and a really important sort of part two to Black Lives Matter?
Absolutely. And it was a phrase that became such a lightning rod, if you will, over the last few years. And I think the power of this report and the value of this report is that it adds nuance to the phrase. So when we asked Black people, would they prefer or would they be in favor of shifting resources from policing to these alternatives, they responded in the affirmative, and the data bears that out, which is important because it's saying, yes, there is a desire to shift funds away from policing and to put it into other areas, other alternatives that would have better outcomes for Black people. And two, it is not just offering a critique of policing and the policing system, it is also answering the question. It's saying, if there's a critique of the policing system, but there are also alternatives that we can work to build, that we can put in place. There are alternatives that we can create, and there's an appetite for those alternatives. And that's very powerful, because a lot of the critique over the last few years was, well, it's just what we're against. It's just defund the police. It's a very one-dimensional analysis of that phrase, when in actually, it's there's support from the data that says, yes, people do want to move funds away from policing, and they have ideas about the alternatives, structures and systems and protocols that can be developed to which they want those funds to go toward instead. And that's a very, very important nuance.
What's the next step from this survey? How do these surveys' results get put into action?
There's some very practical ways that the results from the survey can be put into action. So one of them is, we are already familiar with organizations that have been working to build some of these alternatives in real time. And so we are moving toward a national campaign that will actually bolster these efforts to build these alternatives. At the local level, it's about passing local resolutions to develop crisis response models, mental health crisis response models in municipalities across the country. So that's a very practical intervention that can be put in place, and there's precedent for it. There are existing models. And so our work with the national campaign is to really lift that up, amplify, and get even more support for the continued building of those alternative models in cities across the country. There are also federal implications. So we have the People's Response Act, which was introduced by Representative Cori Bush, and it also focuses on mental health crisis response, albeit at the federal level, and takes a lot of inspiration from the Movement for Black Lives Breathe Act, which was comprehensive omnibus legislation that really defined public safety on our terms. And so the People's Response Act takes a subset of that and advances it at the federal level. So we'll be getting behind that legislation. But the other really practical use for this kind of report is it can be used, one, to counter some of the mythology or some of the inaccurate characterizations about the critique of the policing system, and even the critique of the amount of money that is put into policing and into the carceral state. It gives actual data about what people think, what people believe, and how they feel those resources are being used, and if they feel that they are being used well, and what are some alternative ways that resources can be used. It can be useful at the state level and the federal level. And it gives policymakers, legislators, lawmakers tangible materials to use to back up their advocacy for particular pieces of legislation. And that's very important. So when they're pushing for reallocating resources from one place to another, they actually have the support of the research as to the why. And that can be a very powerful tool, especially in advocacy spaces.
We know that often getting any kind of congressional action at the federal level can be almost impossible in these times. And so I'm wondering if you think that the survey results are also useful for local efforts. You know, city council votes and individuals on city councils who want to pass resolutions diverting money away, because police departments are funded by cities, right? Cities make the choice to pour money into policing at the expense of other projects and programs. And we see in city after city mayors, many of them Democrats, working for police and working to uplift police and working to continually pour more money into policing, are often beholden to police unions. But we're seeing some changes at city council levels where people who might identify as abolitionists are getting elected to city council and are diverting money away from policing. Do you feel that your survey could also be useful at that local level where there might be more promise for change?
Absolutely. And, You know, as I mentioned, we're actually launching a national campaign, and part of that strategy, there's a federal component, but there's a municipal component or a local component to pass these mental health crisis response resolutions at the city level, either through resolution or by ordinance. And it just speaks to the importance of what happens at the local level, because those budgeting decisions, those allocation decisions, are largely made through local governments. And so what this does, what this research does, what this report does, is it gives some heft to those local efforts, provides real data about how people feel about the ways that funds are invested, the ways that their budgets are constructed. And again, it provides some fodder for local policymakers, whether elder people, council people, to be able to articulate clearly an agenda that says, here are the changes, here are the interventions that we should be pushing, and here's why. So it's an incredibly powerful tool and resource for local advocacy efforts, for local policymaking. And also it can be useful at the federal level, but definitely at the local level.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website where people can read the results of the survey themselves and share it.
Absolutely. So they can find it at www.m4bl.org. And so the report is there. And we hope people share it on our platforms. We're also on social media, so folks can engage the data there as well.
Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Dr. Amara Enya, Policy and Research Director for the Movement for Black Lives. We've been discussing the results of a new survey that was conducted among Black Americans on the issue of police funding and divestment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. I'm the Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org. Watch it on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Seattle's world-renowned city council member and socialist firebrand Shama Sawant announced earlier this year that she would not be seeking re-election to her seat. After a decade as an elected official, Sawant has moved on to launch her own worker-led organization called Workers Strike Back and started a new podcast called On Strike. While on the city council, Sawant changed expectations for elected officials, refusing to bow down to financial and political pressures that most of her colleagues accepted, inviting loud and proud protests on issues of labor rights, fair wages, housing and rent, racial justice, caste discrimination, and much more. She was a thorn in the side of the establishment, faced and beat back recall efforts, and has been an ally to progressive causes inside the halls of power. She joins me today to look back at her achievements as an elected official and her hopes for her new ventures. Welcome to the program, Shama.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
It's amazing. I looked back on my archives and realized that you'd been such a regular on this program, almost a dozen conversations with you over the past decade, talking about everything that you've been doing and all the attacks you've faced, but more importantly, the ways in which you have challenged the establishment in Seattle. Why did you decide that 10 years was enough?
We've, as you said, we've demonstrated so thoroughly an unparalleled example. Really, it's unfortunate that it's unparalleled, but that's how it is, of what it means to be a genuine working class representative standing up for the needs and interests of working people and oppressed community members. And what it means is exactly what we have demonstrated in this last decade, which is to be unambiguously loyal to the interests of the people you claim to represent, which automatically means you become enemy number one of the Chamber of Commerce, of big business and billionaire interests, and also the political establishment that represents their interests. And in Seattle, there's really no Republican establishment to speak of. The other eight council members on the Seattle City Council throughout this decade have always been Democrats. In fact, in the last 3 to 5 years, they've been a majority of self-described progressive and labor Democrats. And yet, for the most part, these politicians, and this is the bitter reality that people, working people, have to accept, which is that they for the most part represent the interest of big business despite their progressive labels that they put on themselves. And so what we have shown is that it takes using this elected office as a vehicle for social struggle, for working people's and young people's movements, to win any kind of victory, let alone significant ones like the ones we have won, which is making Seattle the first major city to win the $15 an hour minimum wage, launching the 15 Now movement, which went nationwide, winning the Amazon tax on billionaires, corporate billionaires who have basically used the Washington state as a tax haven, and winning unprecedented renters' rights victories, including victories against oppression, which is, as you mentioned, the landmark historic bill, the outlawing of caste-based discrimination in Seattle, which is the biggest victory against caste oppression outside South Asia ever won.
Right. And we almost had it in California, and our Democratic liberal governor, Gavin Newsom, vetoed it.
Yes, and I think, Sonali, that is actually worth talking about. Why is it that we won in Seattle, and why that bill was defeated in California? That story itself encapsulates exactly what I'm saying here in response to your question about why not run for re-election this year. So I think after a decade of having demonstrated successfully a fighting strategy that is independent of the Democratic Party, we believe that the lessons of what we have won here should not remain just limited to Seattle. And that is why, rather than run for re-election, Socialist Alternative, my organization, and I, as you mentioned, have launched Worker Strike Back, which is a nationwide organization and movement to help organize rank and file union members and non-union workers, because for the most part the workforce is not unionized in the United States because of the decades of attacks on the labor movement.
It also speaks, I think, to this sense of not wanting to get too entrenched in a particular position, right, Shama? I mean, a lot of city council members and elected officials, when you get some power and you realize you can wield it, like to stay there or maybe aim for higher office and keep climbing the political ladder. And that we have this system and a culture of political establishmentarianism, I think, in the United States that encourages elected officials to seek office for the sake of seeking office rather than for the sake of changing things. And I think your stepping down sort of speaks to something as well. I'm wondering if you can pinpoint that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should not underestimate, which I don't think your question is doing, but just to begin responding to that question by first laying out the framework of why it is actually important for working class people and those of us, you know, the millions of Americans who are not represented by the Democrats and Republicans, for us to have our own elected office that unambiguously fights for us and does not make backroom deals with the establishment, you know, with the Democratic Party politicians, including the progressives. So I don't think we can underestimate the importance of having such a position and using it in the way we have done. But at the same time, we also recognize that when we look at the history of American working class, for example, winning victories, many of those were not won because we had an elected position. Many of those were won because we had the correct kind of leadership in every sphere. So what I mean is that whether we have an elected position in City Hall or in Congress, or we're talking about leadership of the labor movement or informal leadership of social movements or social struggle, regardless of which sphere we're talking about, what we as in rank and file working people, people who are watching this and are hungry for social change, are angry at the Democrats and Republicans, what we should be aiming for is leadership that the rank and file can hold accountable. And that's an example of, we've shown an example of that. But I'm trying to really emphasize that it is not specifically about elected leadership. It is about leadership that originates from social struggle. All of this has to be held accountable. And you're absolutely right, Sonali. What we see, not just in the Republican Party, but also in the Democratic Party, we see personality-based politics, which is entirely rooted in personal careerism, as in all these so-called progressive Democrats like Pramila Jayapal, Ro Khanna, Teresa Mosqueda here in Seattle. These are all careerist politicians, which means that they put their position in the Democratic Party ladder, you know, the career ladder, far ahead of any principle they might profess to have been the basis of their political, you know, starting point of their political work or political activism, really. So ultimately, careerism is the death knell for the working class, and the only way we can push back against that is to push back against that idea of politics itself. And so what we have done in Socialist Alternative is completely reject. It's not just not only about the fact that, you know, we put forward working class demands, which is obviously fundamentally different than what the Democratic Party does, which is they don't ever make any promises either. I mean, if you look at what they're actually saying, they don't actually make concrete promises because they don't want to be held to any concrete promise. But in addition to that, just the whole model of politics that they present is they're busy climbing the rungs of the political establishment, which means at every step of the way, you sell out those who are vulnerable, those who are marginalized, poor people, working class people. So in other words, if renters, for example, are fighting for their rights to, which it automatically means that if you as an elected person are going to actually stand with renters, and I want everybody who's watching this to hear me correctly, not say that you're with renters, but actually stand with renters, that comes as a package with making enemies out of corporate landlords. So there is no way you can keep corporate landlords happy and fulfill the needs of renters, because under capitalism, the needs of those who are left out, as in the vast majority of working people and the poor, and the greed of the billionaire class and the political establishment and NGO leaders and all of them that feed on them, these two things are diametrically opposed to each other. So any politician who's saying I can represent both, I'll keep everyone happy, is either deluding themselves or are trying to fool you.
Now, the way in which the Democratic Party establishment, of course, also works is that if you speak out of turn, you can't take advantage of their machine for your re-election hopes. And so for you, Shama, as an independent, as somebody who was linked to Socialist Alternative, an independent political grassroots organizing effort, how did that, different approach keep you, first of all, accountable to grassroots, and then also not beholden to relying on an establishment to keep, you know, funding your re-election campaigns over 10 years, for example?
I think one of the things that is least understood, because we haven't had an example like our elected office, is what happens once you get elected, and what happens is that the machinery, the political machinery of capitalism, exists to defend the interests of the system, to defend the interests of those who benefit from the system. So by definition, what we consider government under capitalism, whether it is City Hall or US Congress, is fundamentally not set up to deliver justice or betterment in society. It exists there to manage the inherent conflicts that arise from having a deeply divided system, where you have a minority benefiting in the system and the vast majority not benefiting and actually losing out, and the others, you know, the small minority at the top benefiting at the expense of the rest of us. So when you have that kind of deep inequality underlying in society, then automatically what it means is that the way the government institutions, all of institutions of the capitalist government, the way they are set up is to basically manage all of these interests. And for the most part, the way they, when I say manage, what it means is that for the most part, they deliver what is demanded by the ruling elite, but they try to do it especially in developed countries like the United States. The way they try to do it is by maybe offering a few crumbs here and there for ordinary people. And so if you accept that model, then, as I said before, you've already sold out. Because if you accept that model, then you are not going to understand that your role is not to join in the managing of the capitalist system. Your role as an elected representative is to disrupt that status quo. And the best and most effective way you can disrupt it is not about just making speeches. It's the most effective way of disrupting the status quo is to actually win significant victories for the working class. And the way you win is by recognizing that you have to change the balance of power. And the only way the balance of power can shift towards working people away from the elite at any given moment under capitalism is if working people build mass movements to tip the scales in their favor. And so fundamentally, if that would be our role as working class representatives, to use our office as a vehicle to build that kind of movement in order to tip the scales in the favor of working people, because no one person, however extraordinary they might be, is going to achieve that. So, you know, if you go with the mindset that, oh, I'm a good person, I got elected, and I'm going to win these victories for for the people I represent, then you are beholden to the machinery, and, you know, beholden to the beneficence of that machinery. And, you know, AOC at one moment was actually quite honest. You know, she and the squad have completely failed in delivering anything for working people. And in fact, they've also sold out by actually, for example, AOC signing the Iron Dome or voting present on the Iron Dome vote, and, you know, in relation to the Israeli state's machinery, war machinery against Palestinians in Gaza, by voting to break the railroad workers' strike. I mean, there's any number of examples. But she had a moment of honesty recently when she said that if you go against, and this goes to your question, Sonali, if you go against the Democratic Party in any real, serious way, then it causes, in her words, this is a quote from her, relational harm. And that really goes to I don't know if she meant to be honest in this way, but that goes to the crux of the difference between someone like her and someone like me, in the sense that if you believe that your personal relationship with the Democrats, with the power brokers, is important to you because your day-to-day life should not be too hard, then that's it. All is lost. You have sold out by definition. So I can tell you from my own example that my life has been the exact opposite, in the sense that Democrats, including the progressive Democrats, including women, Latina women Democrats, have, you know, on a personal level, if you look at it, I have any number of stories of how badly they have treated me. But that's the point. It is politics. And if you are steadfastly representing working people, expect to be treated badly by the Democrats. But understand that you are not there for your personal comfort, and they are not your work colleagues. This is not like workers in a workplace who should actually be in solidarity with one another. I am not in solidarity with the representatives of the capitalist class. So when I go to work in City Hall, I don't look at it as a normal workplace where these are my colleagues. I look at it as a battleground, because that's what it is. It's a political battleground. And unless you understand that, you won't really understand what our role is.
Another issue that, of course, is front and center now as you and I are speaking is Israel's war on Gaza, Israel's assault on Gaza, genocidal assault on Gaza, which is... another issue that the Democrats are unshakable on. They are uncompromising in their support for Israel. And you've led in, I think, what might be your last major issue on the city council, calls for your colleagues to back a citywide, you know, for the city of Seattle to call for a ceasefire. Tell me about this particular move and whether you see this issue as well as one that your colleagues may regret being on the wrong side of history of.
I think all the interests related to the Democratic Party who are either actively participating or quietly, tacitly allowing the warmongering to continue are absolutely going to be on the wrong side of history, as you and I know, Sonali, and many of the people who are watching this will know. In fact, this is such a historic moment where there's been a generational shift in the United States, where the younger generation is not going along with the pro-Israeli straight propaganda. And let's be clear on the outset, being against the Israeli state does not make you anti-Semitic. In fact, we are fighting against both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. We are fighting against oppression of any kind, no matter what community it is. We are against oppression internationally.
And huge numbers of Jewish Americans are fighting in solidarity with Palestinians.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, there have been some of the most courageous actions have been the nonviolent civil disobedience actions, like at the Grand Central Station in New York City, like in the halls of Congress. In fact, those actions were in addition to the anti-war protests as a whole, were what finally forced the progressive the chair of the Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, to at least start talking about ceasefire. I mean, but as you said correctly, and I totally agree, none of them is actually fighting for ceasefire, but the protests actually are forcing them. Now, Ro Khanna is saying he supports ceasefire, but nobody's actually going to take a real stand against the warmongering of their own party. You know, so, you know, the story is that on November 7th, I brought forward a resolution condemning the Israeli state's war on Gaza, also condemning Hamas for the violence and pointing out that that kind of terrorism is not the way to solve it. And in fact, it actually worsens and compounds actions of terror, and that we are against the state terror conducted by Israel, and the complete inhumanity of killing thousands of babies and children and women and elderly, and the unspeakable horrors that they're perpetrating on the Palestinian people in Gaza especially, but also in the occupied West Bank. And not only calling for ceasefire, the resolution also called for the ending of U.S. funding for the Israeli state's war machine, and calls for the end of the occupation of Palestinian lands, and also, you know, raised its voice against anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. So what happened on November 7th was another shameful moment in the annals of the Democrats on the Seattle City Council, which is that I did not even get a second for my motion for the resolution. And it was incredible in the sense that it really angered the rank and file of the anti-war movement. It included many Palestinian Americans, but it was by no means limited to Palestinian Americans. Working people, union members of all ethnicities and nationalities who live in Seattle were absolutely angered. Based on the basis of that phenomenal support we had from the anti-war protests in Seattle, we brought that resolution back for a vote on November 21st. And Sonali, it was just amazing. Like you said, you know, here we are wrapping up our city council tenure and in our almost final days, we had this moving city council meeting where we were able to mobilize over 5,000 500 people. Many of them came from the anti-war protests, from the Palestinian community, from the Jewish community, working people, union members. It was incredible. I had tears in my eyes, just looking at the incredible opposition to warmongering, and many of them saying in public testimonials, saying, here we are, our public schools are crumbling, many of them are being shut down, people are becoming homeless, rent is sky high in Seattle, home ownership is completely out of reach for most people, and all these tens of billions of dollars being handed to a war machine that is spilling blood of innocent people overseas. We don't accept this. So just the political analysis that was presented by ordinary people was also just tremendous. And what do you think the Democrats did in the face of this, including those Latina Democrats and so on? None of them, first of all, showed up in person because, you have a Zoom option. But imagine staying at home, or worse yet, many of them were in City Hall, but they didn't dare face the 500 people who had come to City Hall. Sonali, it was just incredible. It's just embarrassing in how shameful they are, that they were literally hiding. And I'm not exaggerating. They literally were hovering just outside the chambers in this private, an entrance that nobody else can go in because it's a key card entrance. And then refusing to come inside the city council chambers, but heading back into their private offices and doing this meeting over Zoom. And I can't tell you how much that angered the people. They're like, we are here because thousands upon thousands of people, including babies, are dying, and you can't even bother to show up. No matter which way you're voting, at least have the courage to face us. But they didn't have the courage. I was the lone person on the city council dais. And then not only did they not show up, they had the temerity to water down the resolution. So at the end of the day, the resolution that we won was watered down by them. And that's, that's shame on the Democrats. At the same time, I think we have to also take note of the fact that that night, Seattle became the largest city in the United States to win a ceasefire resolution. And the Democrats were absolutely loath to do anything, as indicated by the first time when they didn't even give me a second in my motion. But the fact that they were forced to vote on this, that shows the power of anti-war movements. And we need this movement to grow, and we need real leadership in this movement.
Shama, we just have a few minutes left. I want to ask you about what's next for you. Tell me about Workers Strike Back and On Strike, your new podcast. Maybe you can begin by reflecting on the fact that the United Auto Workers became the largest union to call for a ceasefire on the Israel's war on Gaza, just indicating the power of organized labor to be militant and achieve success.
I think that's very, very important what you've mentioned. The UAW calling for a ceasefire in the wake of their own historic victory through the strike action that they did against all the three, the big three automakers, Ford, GM, and Stellantis. I think this is incredible. It shows that this is what the labor movement needs to be doing, calling for strike actions and going on strike to win workplace victories, and at the same time, taking a stand on the issues on issues of oppression, and taking a position on an international issue. It really is an inspiring example, a brilliant example of what the labor movement should be doing. And it's really important also to mention that in the wake of their victory after their strike, they have not stopped there. Not only did they call for the ceasefire, but they also have put a call out. Sean Fain, the president of UAW, has put a call out for unionizing the auto workforce as a whole. And I think that's been really inspiring. I'm hearing of a lot of workers sort of writing to UAW saying, I want to unionize my workplace. And I think making that concretely happen is very important. And all of this that we're talking about UAW also relates to another historic unionizing drive that is going on, which is at Amazon's world's largest air hub, which is in Northern Kentucky at the Cincinnati, Kentucky, Northern Kentucky Airport. They call it KCVG. It's the largest air hub of Amazon in the world. It's a linchpin in their whole machinery. So in other words, if KCVG workers shut it down, then all of Amazon's, worldwide project will be disrupted. And so it's a real choke point for Amazon. And it's, that's what makes this unionizing drive so historic right now that's happening.
And those are the kinds of stories you're covering on your podcast?
Those are the kinds of stories we're covering on our video broadcast On Strike. People can check it out. If you go to YouTube and search On Strike Show, you'll find it. And in fact, our most recent episode, which was released, it's a weekly video broadcast, and the episode from last week actually is an update on this KCBG struggle, because we launched this broadcast with a story on this union drive, historic union drive, and we went back to KCBG last week. And the reason we went back is because the union drive is really heating up. And that also means that the union busting by Amazon bosses is also ramping up. And it's really important, everybody who is watching this, to stand in solidarity with the KCBG workers. So I really urge everybody who's watching this to go to workersstrikeback.org, all one word, workersstrikeback, to help us build this campaign. Please donate to Workers Strike Back, because a lot of those funds we use to help the union drive like KCVG. We've also been on the picket lines in solidarity with UAW. And I should just mention, Workers Strike Back is not just an abstract organization. We are concretely fighting for living wages and $25 an hour minimum wage, for union jobs for all, Medicare for all. Workers Strike Back is also fighting against discrimination and oppression. And last but not least, Workers Strike Back is also declaring that the Democrats and Republicans have both failed us, and that working people in the United States need a party of our own. And I think there's never been, just talking about that last demand, there's never been a more favorable moment for the left to provide leadership to, you know, building towards a new political organization for working people. Because look at the anger. I mean, obviously there's massive anger against the Republicans and also against Trump. But in reality, there is a real danger of Trump 2.0, not because the majority of Americans favor him, but because of the anger that working people and young people correctly feel at Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. I mean, the degree to which Biden's approval rating has plummeted, both because of the failure to provide for basic economic needs of working people and young people, and also the warmongering, especially in relation to the Israeli state against Gaza, has completely plummeted the numbers. And in fact, among Arab Americans, now we have a hashtag trending, hashtag abandon Biden, which is all showing you that there is deep anger against the Democrats. But what's missing is the actual alternative. If you abandon Biden, which I agree with, but what else? You're not going to vote for Trump. Who else? And so all of this really opens up the need for an organization like Workers Strike Back that will help to mobilize and organize the rank and file inside the labor movement, and also those who are not don't have a union, but working and young people who want to fight back, both in their workplace and against the warmongering. And that's, you know, Workers Strike Back is showing an example of the kind of political organizations we need.
Shama, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Give out those websites again for Workers Strike Back and the podcast. I guess you can find it on the same website?
Yes, you can definitely find On Strike. If you go to workersstrikeback, all one word, .org, you can find the link to On Strike as well. But if you just directly want to go to the video broadcast, just go on YouTube and search On Strike Show.
And we'll post links to that from our website. Shama, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll be having you back on as you step down from your decade on the Seattle City Council. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much, Sonali. And I should mention, we would love to have you on our On Strike broadcast.
Oh, I'd love to be on. Thank you so much again. My guest has been Shama Sawant. She's a member of Socialist Alternative, had become the first socialist in a century to be elected to the Seattle City Council. And she's been on the council for a decade, stepping down now and going on to work on her new organization, Workers Strike Back, and also as the host of a new video podcast called On Strike. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media, and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO colorful, independent, and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. But right now, during our end-of-the-year campaign, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us to reach our goal of $75,000 by December 31st. Be a ray of light in your community by making your tax-deductible donation at kboo.fm/give today.
Broadcasting the